We've been looking at personality theory of Carl Rogers, and we have just been considering the role of the therapist in that theory. The primary tool used by the therapist for extending unconditional acceptance is the employment of what's called the non-directive approach to therapy. That is, a response to the client that never intimates that anything that he does or has done is wrong and never suggests that he needs to change anything. Rather, the therapist merely reflects back to the client what the client has said. The client might say, "I hate school." And the therapist would respond, "So you don't find school particularly appealing these days." This approach provides a non-judgmental atmosphere that enables the client to feel the unconditional acceptance of the therapist and therefore to accept himself just as he is, not based on performance. It's important that we recognize that from Rogers' perspective, only the individual knows what is right for him, since his self-actualizing tendency is the only trustworthy source of guidance. Therefore, no one else is in a position to tell the individual how to live. All that the therapist or anyone else can do is to convey acceptance, which will free the individual to follow his self-actualizing tendency and hence to be the person that he was meant to be. This is the only remedy. This view that only the individual can and should make choices for himself establishes compatibility with existentialism and gives psychological credence to the assertion of the hippie movement that the individual has a right to do his own thing. In effect, Carl Rogers was agreeing with the hippies by saying that your self-actualizing tendency is the only safe guide, and therefore whatever your thing is, whatever you decide to do, that's okay for you. We see then that Rogers' contribution to the counseling field and to society as a whole has included two crucial concepts, the first being unconditional acceptance, and the second being self-esteem, and specifically the non-performance-based self-esteem that is so prevalent in our society today. That is unconditional self-acceptance. These concepts have become dominant features of the secular and evangelical mindset. Next, let's consider the applicability of Rogers' views to life, Rogerianism as a way of life. Notice how Rogers' theories provide not only a therapeutic model, but an ethic and an approach to life. Regarding its ethical implications, as already mentioned, only the person knows what is best for him. Therefore, it is unethical to tell a person that what he is doing is wrong. That is judgmentalism. The condemning person is casting himself into the role of God, assuming that he knows what is right for someone else. Therefore, conveying acceptance to another person is always right, and being critical of another person because of his choices or lifestyle is always wrong. One can see, for example, how this mindset leads to the acceptance of homosexuality, making those who do not accept homosexuality the real sinner. It also provides a foundation for abortion by giving preeminence to the choice of the individual. It explains why when our previous president was caught in sexual promiscuity and dishonesty, his approval ratings actually increased. The American public responded by conveying to him that they accepted him unconditionally. Conversely, the ratings of the Congress that impeached him, that passed judgment on him, declined, since they committed the only sin of the Rogerian system, non-acceptance or judgmentalism. The same ethical orientation is applicable to virtually every area of life. For example, Rogers endorsed open marriage, that is, marriage in which people give their spouses the right to infidelity. In other words, I accept you regardless of who you sleep with. To do otherwise would be to accept conditionally, damaging the self-esteem of one's spouse. And as we damage the self-esteem of somebody's, of our spouse by accepting them conditionally, that of course is going to keep them from being the person they should be, and as a result keep them from being the best spouse they can be, and therefore we hurt ourselves in the process. It is important to recognize that this Rogerian ethic does not follow the old ethical perspective that the right of the individual ends where the nose of his neighbor begins. Rather, it gives the individual unlimited authority to do his thing. This is seen in the case of abortion. The old rationale for abortion was that the fetus was not a real person. But the advent of partial birth abortion demonstrates that that was merely a smokescreen and that those clamoring for choice are in fact advocating unlimited rights for the chooser, including taking the life of another. In other words, if it's a mother's thing to abort her child, even though that is a viable child, that is allowable based on an existential and based on a Rogerian approach to life. The individual following his self-actualizing tendency must be viewed as doing the right thing for them. We see then that both existentialism and Rogerian psychology provide the individual with absolute rights, the right to do his own thing regardless of what that might be. In terms of providing a way of life, we can see how the Rogerian system has broad application to almost every aspect of existence. The application of education is obvious. If a student is doing poor academically or having disciplinary problems, it is because parents or other significant others have not extended unconditional acceptance to them, and thus their self-esteem has been crushed. They can't accept themselves regardless of how they live. Therefore, the school is cast into the role of the therapist, extending unconditional acceptance to the students so that he can accept himself unconditionally, that is, develop non-performance-based self-esteem. This will enable him to do his best academically and become a good citizen. Likewise, marriage and all other relationships are maximized when people accept each other unconditionally. Not only does Rogerian theory provide an ethical system and a guide to relationships, but also it provides the individual with a perspective on life that will enable him to succeed. He needs to constantly assure himself that he is okay just as he is, regardless of how he has been living, and that his performance should in no way affect how he feels about himself, his self-esteem. In other words, he should never feel pangs of conscience or guilt. Likewise, the individual should feel free to follow his intuitions and inclinations wherever they might lead him, being cautious not to be influenced by the input of others. This approach to life will provide harmony within and the guidance and confidence to succeed. The bottom line is that the Rogerian model provides a rather comprehensive approach to life. It is not just a therapeutic structure, but a theory to live by. The ultimate question is whether Roger's system represents the truth, that is, whether it really works. If it does, one can quickly see what a superior approach to life it is. Imagine a family where each person accepts each other person unconditionally, and where this acceptance enables all of them to be healthy individuals, living together in harmony, and each one maximizing his or her potential and achieving success. Extend that utopian scenario beyond the bounds of the family to our educational system, the business world, social spheres, justice system, and society as a whole. One can imagine the potential for revolutionizing life as we know it that might be achieved through this system. In light of such a warm, positive prospect, it is little wonder that the Rogerian perspective caught on so quickly, was embraced so warmly by our society and the various elements within our society. However, if Rogers was wrong, if unconditional acceptance does not lead the individual to become a fully functioning person, but rather gives an encouragement to the perpetrator to continue on in his bad deeds or do even worse, then this experiment could end in disaster. For example, what if the boy playing the video games receiving unconditional acceptance just continues on playing video games and turns out to be a dropout? And we can take that negative example and multiply it many times, and we can see that if Rogers is wrong, if unconditional acceptance really doesn't do what it is purported to do by Rogers, this system being applied to a society could result in disaster on all fronts. Next, let's consider the non-humanistic nature of Rogers' views. Humanistic psychology takes a more favorable view of the human being than its predecessors in that it depicts him as having within himself the desire and the capacity to be a fully functioning individual. Nonetheless, we see that Roger's understanding of the human being makes him a victim, just as do the other two major personality theories. In Roger's model, people are victims of the acceptance of significant others. According to Rogers, significant others control the destiny of the individual by the form of acceptance that they extend to him. Therefore, the three most prominent personality theories describe the human being as a victim of some force beyond his control. In wrapping up our discussion of Rogers, let me cite a few other psychologists that reflect a Rogerian orientation. They would include Rollo May, Gordon Allport, Viktor Frankl, and Albert Perls with his Gestalt therapy. What are some of the problems with personality theories? In the previous lesson, we evaluated personality theories in general, concluding that they are too macroscopic to be scientifically substantiated, and they deal with aspects of human nature that are out of reach of scientific research. In addition, we concluded that human bias makes objectivity in these areas dealing with human nature even more difficult. In this lesson, we have described the major personality theories so that we can observe how these limitations, the limitations on research that we just mentioned, apply to each of these personality theories specifically. First, let's consider behaviorism. The central teaching of behaviorism is that the personality has no influence over the person's response to external stimuli, but rather that the individual functions as a biological machine, and the stimulus comes in, the response goes out, and the individual has no control over that process. This position cannot be substantiated for the reasons cited above. This series suggests that all individuals receiving the same input would respond in the same way. However, virtually all experiments would demonstrate just the opposite, that individuals receiving certain input would respond in a different way. Out of hundreds of people receiving a traffic ticket, there would be a wide variety of responses. The behaviorist would assert that this is because each one has been programmed differently by his environment. And this brings us to the crux of the problem. To run a meaningful experiment, we would have to find 100 people who have been programmed exactly the same way. And, of course, that would be impossible. We cannot even come close. No two people are programmed exactly alike. Nor is there any way to filter out all of the variables. People are just too complex, and their environments are too complex, to be able to design a scientifically meaningful experiment that would substantiate this concept. Science also has difficulty proving that the human being makes decisions solely on prior programming because it does not have access to the human decision-making faculty. And even if many people did respond in a similar way, the researcher still has not shown why they responded as they did. Behaviorism claims that the reason for the similar response is similar programming. But why people do what they do is a question beyond the reach of the scientist. Even if the researcher asked the subject why he did what he did, there is no way of demonstrating that the person responding was telling the truth. And the subject might not know himself why he did what he did. He might not even know his motivations himself. So having him talk about it really doesn't prove anything. The fact is that the core behavioristic concept, the fact that people have no control over the stimulus response mechanism, is unprovable scientifically. Likewise, the core thesis of Freud, that we are controlled by our unconscious, has yet to be proven. Freud certainly did not prove it. In the previous lesson, Duane Schultz was quoted as attesting to the unscientific process used by Freud of developing psychoanalysis. Schultz, in citing the work of Hall and Lindsay in their book, Theories of Personality, which is one of the major references on personality theory, notes that, quote, Freud's writings contain his conclusions, but not A, the data from which the conclusions were derived, B, the method by which the data were analyzed, nor C, any systematic account of his empirical findings. Further, since Freud did not attempt to quantify his data, it is impossible to determine the reliability or statistical significance of his findings, end quote. Therefore, rather than providing support for his theory, even the support that he might have had, Freud expected the psychological world to take his word for the validity of his conclusions. Apparently, they did. Freud had an extremely dominating personality, and no doubt this was a factor in the acceptance of his conclusions in the absence of scientific support. Probably more significant was the fact that Freud's theories held great appeal to the secular world of his day. They were happy enough, without scientific evidence, to adopt a view of human personality other than the one advanced by God in the scriptures. Not only did Freud fail to support his position scientifically, but in the intervening years, no one else has been able to advance scientific support for Freud's theory. A case might be made for the position that an unconscious aspect of our personality influences our behavior. But science has not come close to substantiating the assertions that the unconscious has the capacity to victimize us, that it is the ultimate force behind our pathologies, and that the cure is psychoanalysis. In his book, How Christian is Christian Counseling, by Gary L. Almey, he quotes Alan A. Stone, a Harvard professor of psychiatry and law, as observing, quote, "Psychoanalysis, both as theory and as practice, is an art form that belongs to the humanities and not to the natural sciences. It is closer to literature than to science," end quote. Almey not only notes the lack of scientific evidence to establish that Freudian concepts are true, but asserts the presence of evidence indicating that they are false. Quote, "In recent years, a significant literature has emerged, both secular and Christian, showing that Freud's fundamental theories of counseling psychology are not truth." Garth Wood, in his book, The Myth of Neurosis, notes the admission by psychoanalysts that after practicing their theory for 80 years, they have not gathered evidence demonstrating its scientific validity. The core concept of the Rogerian model is also out of reach of science. The view that human pathologies stem from the failure of significant others to accept the individual unconditionally, and that these pathologies can be resolved through the experience of unconditional acceptance, is both unproved and unprovable. How a researcher would even begin scientifically to substantiate so broad a claim is mind-boggling. The individual human being is astronomically complex by himself, but when placed in relationship with others, those already astronomical complexities increase exponentially. To prove that unconditional acceptance is the ultimate key to health and change, that the individual possesses a self-actualizing tendency that constitutes an infallible guide, that self-esteem, unrelated to one's lifestyle, is a beneficial virtue, these claims have not been proven scientifically, nor can they be. Attempts have been made to establish scientifically small pieces to the puzzle, but this does not validate the theory as a whole. For example, Rogers concluded that the client was growing toward a healthier personality when he began to use the first-person singular more frequently. Being assertive enough to say, "I think this," or "I want that," conveyed to Rogers that the personality was becoming stronger. To substantiate the increase of the use of the first-person singular as therapy progressed, Rogers could maintain a count. It would be easy enough to count the number of times that the person used the word "I" or "me." However, all this proves is that the longer a person is subjected to the Rogerian therapy, the more he uses the word "I." It does not prove Rogers' underlying hypothesis that the client is becoming healthier. In fact, one study I read indicates that the greatest non-physical factor related to heart disease was the frequency of the use of the first-person singular. The more the person used the words "I" and "me," the more likely it was that he'd have heart disease. Since it is difficult to imagine that psychological health produces physical sickness, based on this correlation between the use of the first-person singular and heart disease, it is reasonable to conclude that the frequent use of the first-person singular, rather than constituting the hallmark of of psychological health may represent an indicator of psychological sickness. But even if Rogers could have demonstrated scientifically the relationship between the use of the word I and psychological health, which would represent a daunting task, validating this small piece of his therapeutic model would fall far short of establishing the truth of the model as a whole. To do so would require not only validation of all of the pieces, but proof that all of the pieces fit together, a task that places the project far out of the reach of science. Any attempt to validate scientifically Rogers' theory also faces the hurdle that key elements in the experiment are far beyond the reach of science. And we've talked about this previously. As we noted earlier, to crawl inside the human being and discover why he does what he does is beyond the scope of the work of the scientist. So it'd be virtually impossible to demonstrate scientifically that a teenager's personality was warped because his parents didn't accept him unconditionally. The counterintuitive nature of personality theories. It's also important to note that central concepts in each of the three major personality theories cited above and many of the subsidiary concepts of the latter two are counterintuitive. Perhaps it might be argued that even though personality theories cannot be supported scientifically, they should be adopted because they just seem to make sense. In fact, Duane Schultz, in A History of Modern Psychology, advances this argument. Schultz observes, quote, "Belief in psychoanalysis is based on the intuitive grounds of a perceived appearance of plausibility in Freud's system," end quote. He then quotes from a book by E. Heidebreder, who further expands on this point. Quote, "Anyone who accepts or rejects the psychoanalytic theories does so by means of the same kind of reasoning that gives him 1,001 judgments he is forced to make in everyday life on the basis of insignificant and inadequate evidence. Such estimates, growing out of a multitude of impressions and interpretations, guesses and insights, often result in unshakable convictions, convictions which may be right or wrong, but which, from the standpoint of science, cannot be recognized as either proved or disproved." Schultz and Heidebreder are suggesting that in the absence of scientific support for psychoanalysis, we might still embrace this theory on intuitive grounds. Heidebreder is correct in asserting that many of the positions we hold are born out of intuition and common sense rather than scientific research. For example, for years before science demonstrated the harm caused by smoking, many people intuitively recognized that this was the case. However, the mistake made by Schultz and Heidebreder is the assumption that Freudian concepts possess the qualities that would encourage or deserve this intuitive, common sense type of acceptance. In fact, common sense and intuition do not commend any of the major personality theories to us. Rather, our intuition and common sense seem to advise us that these theories are not correct. For example, most of us sense that we are in control of our decisions, contrary to the teaching of behaviorism. In addition, since the strict behavioral view asserts that nothing but the environment impacts behavior, this not only excludes influence from human volition, but also denies any impact from genetics. It is counterintuitive to believe that a person's genetic makeup has no impact on his response to a stimulus. Nor, as suggested by Freud, do we believe that we are controlled by our unconscious. And if you are convinced that your unconscious controls you, when your spouse uses that defense for spending several thousand dollars on something that he or she has wanted, you'll probably reject the concept. However, that position is only the beginning of sorrows for the Freudian personality theory. The view that the personality of a very young child is fraught with sexual cravings, that an infant son is sexually attracted to his mother and anxious about his father retaliating by emasculating him, that our success or failure at potty training represents a major formative personality factor, that people are more pathological because of society's sexual mores, all these Freudian concepts run counter to our intuitive perception of life and humanity. The case for the counterintuitive nature of Rogers' ideas is more difficult to make because those concepts have become so entrenched as part of both our secular and evangelical worldviews that they make sense to the contemporary individual, who also accepts the rationale supporting these concepts as being perfectly legitimate. However, to those of an earlier era not indoctrinated with Rogerian concepts, this would not be the case. For example, it would not be intuitive to the traditional parent of the era prior to the 60s that accepting a child unconditionally represented a healthy approach to child rearing. Rather, he would have viewed expressing disapproval for bad behavior as necessary for the child's well-being. Of course, the contemporary individual would respond that we should disapprove of the inappropriate behavior of the child, but not of his person. This response would puzzle the traditional parent who had never thought of distinguishing between the child and his behavior, or believed that to do so was rational or possible. After further thought, he would probably view this as an artificial and unworkable distinction because the child was the source of the behavior and therefore that behavior represented who he was. It is a reflection of his character. Therefore, he would probably view the child as bad to the extent that he did bad things and good to the extent that he did good things. For him, the Rogerian view of unconditional acceptance would be counterintuitive, and a belief that this approach to child rearing was healthy may even arouse his ire. So there would be no point and perhaps no opportunity to try to move him to the next level of discussion, including non-performance-based self-esteem, suggesting that if his son played hooky from school on a regular basis and got flunking grades, that the child should feel great about himself, and that in so doing, this would provide a remedy for his solution. For him, for this traditional parent, this line of thinking would really go against the grain. We might pity our traditional father as being unenlightened, that is, until we ask whether parents are doing a better job today with their kids, having the insights of Rogers, or whether they did better back in the days prior to Rogers. Or to put it differently, maybe the teaching of Rogers are intuitive to us because our intuition has been warped. Let's consider the troublesome roots of the major personality theories. It is noteworthy that the three major personality theories described above flow out of secular philosophies. The behavioristic approach rests squarely on the materialistic philosophical orientation, rejecting the existence of the non-material human components. Freud was an evolutionist and viewed the belief in religion as a neurosis. Rogers' perspective is existential in nature, having as a foundational tenet that objective truth does not exist and that consequently only the individual can determine what is right for himself. As evangelicals, the fact that these theories have such deep roots in unbiblical philosophies should give cause for concern. It is unlikely that theories coming from these sources can escape pollution. Victimization in personality theories. It is also troublesome that each of these personality theories portrays the individual as a victim. This assignment of victim status to human beings connotes that he has no control over his behavior, but rather that it is determined by forces beyond his control. Behaviorism views the human being as a victim of the programming of society, Freud as a victim of the unconscious, and Rogers as a victim of treatment by significant others. In assigning victim status to human beings, these personality theories are asserting that wrongdoings of individuals are not their fault, and that they should not be held responsible for them. Rather, it is the responsibility of society to fix the problems of the individual by programming him better, healing his unconscious, or providing unconditional acceptance. By way of conclusion, the evaluation above does not bode well for the three major personality theories. It leads us to the conclusion that they have not been scientifically validated, are counterintuitive, are founded on the sand of unbiblical secular philosophical soil, and represent the human being as a victim. In the lesson that follows, we will consider the validity of these personality theories from the perspective of research that has been done. This concludes 6.1.